All right, welcome everyone. I will go around and say hello to Amelia and Shintai, Shoketsu, Claudia, Bob, Ellen, Colleen, Matt, Marvin, Pat, Mark, Susan, Sam, Adine, Jim, Paulette, Cinda, and Ruth Ann. So, no repeats today. No double names. Had quite a lot of those lately. Let's see. In terms of announcements, next weekend, we will be having a Jukai ceremony, an in-person Jukai ceremony, in a park, outdoors in a park. But as somebody asked, we're not really inviting anybody except for the preceptees and their immediate family, because there are seven preceptees plus me and a few people helping with the ceremony. And so if each of them bring one or two people, we're getting up to our 25 maximum number. So in the interest of not going over our legal gathering size of 25, but there's been talk of somebody, you know, hooking up to Zoom via cell tower and you know, zooming it. In addition, there will be at least two folks taking the precepts remotely, because they don't want to risk even the in-person thing in the park. So I can't imagine that won't be an invite thing that people could attend if they want to.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
I'm noticing that emotionally, I don't really want to miss the Jukai, because I take that as an opportunity to renew my commitment. Mm-hmm. So some kind of, you know, I'm accustomed to following up things that I miss with a recording, but I'm hoping that it's documented somehow so I can have some kind of participation. I can participate somehow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and maybe, I hadn't thought about when we would be doing the online ceremony, but I don't know, maybe we would just make it, maybe we would make it part of our Sunday service, because it is something, you're right, that even those of us who have taken Jukai before use it as kind of like a renewal of our vows each year. So I'll think about that. And then does anybody want to say something about the upcoming Awakening to Whiteness series? I think that's still open to participation, right? Shoketsu, do you want to say something about it?
We have 15 people signed up, so we're kind of full. But people are certainly welcome. It's a 6-month Awakening to Whiteness Reeducation and Affinity Group for white folks to learn together how systems of white supremacy and racial injustice embedded in the structures of American society and culture. We're going to start with orientation, which will give you an opportunity to hear what it's all going to be about. And that is going to be on the 8th, which is this Wednesday, from 6 to 8. If you haven't signed up and you're still interested, send me an email. And I will add you to the list. And it will be here at the same Zoom number. Material for the first class will be available online soon, and go ahead and read it if you want to get a head start, but you don't have to read it before orientation unless you want to.
I don't think that there needs to be a cap on the number okay. who are coming to the orientation. And there's a possibility now, Shoketsu and Junryu organized this and they listed out a bunch of Thursday dates for meeting.
Right.
But if there ended up being a bunch of people, at the orientation who decided they wanted to do this and that time did not work, the idea is that this is a small cohort thing. So you end up going through this whole course with 5 or 6 people and you stay with that group. So it could be that there was a cohort that met on another day or time. So if you're interested, I encourage you to let Shoketsu know. If you don't know, have her email, you can email just info@brightwayzen.org and let me know. And they can see if you might be able to fit in or maybe even do a meeting at a different time or day. All right. Any other announcements that I should remember? All right. Okay. So my talk today, I'm calling Tapping Into Our Deepest Desires Instead of Struggling with Self-Discipline. So I think I've talked to quite a few folks who, especially since the lockdown, we're left a lot to our own devices in terms of our practice, in terms of sitting enough and doing whatever it is that we want to have as part of our practice. So some of us have better luck with so-called self-discipline than others. So I wanted to talk today about an alternative to self-discipline. I've never found self-discipline to be very, I wouldn't even say I haven't found it easy. I haven't found it almost possible. It's like if there's a part of me that wants that, this is what we're going to do, I'm even less likely to do it. It's like there's other parts of me that are like, well, screw that, don't tell me what to do. And so there we go. So first of all, I wanted to just invite us to think about what is possible in our practice. Because I think a central part of Buddhism is really arousing our aspirations. And not just our aspirations for, a little bit of stress reduction, a little bit more peace in our human relationships. Those things are great. And there's certainly no need to be dissatisfied with what we might see as, just small mundane benefits of our practice. But it really is part of Buddhism is really looking like Buddhahood is possible for each one of us. And we have many different sets of ideals that describe what is possible for human beings to become, what's possible for us to develop. And as many of you are familiar with the Brahma Viharas, starting off with loving kindness or friendliness, goodwill, and the idea that we could feel that sincerely for all beings, not just some, not just our favorite ones, but even for our enemies. There's compassion, it's the second Brahma Vihara, what that goodwill feels like when we see beings suffer. Sympathetic joy, taking when we feel goodwill for beings and we see them happy. It's a sincere, open-hearted generosity, no envy, no jealousy, no judgment, just happy for other beings. And then equanimity. There's also the paramitas. Generosity, you know, the descriptions of generosity, of really pure generosity, of being this, you know, when you have something and someone needs it, just hand it over, you know, which is how many of us could say that we do that, right? Most of us are like, well, I don't know, am I going to need this? Do they really need it? You know, so that handing things over, not being attached, morality, forbearance, energy. That's one that can be very, very tricky. I mean, I was dozing during Zazen today. I got enough sleep last night. I don't know. I mean, it's a tricky thing. We don't want to get into like self-blame, but on the other hand, you can do some mental experiments with yourself and think about what's possible. Sometimes I think, if I knew this was my last meditation period ever, if I knew that I was going to die this afternoon, I would not be asleep. Like, the energy would come from somewhere, and it really would have to do with my attitude. Meditation and wisdom are other paramitas. Then there's Dogen's Three Minds. We're studying the Tenzo Kyokan on Tuesdays. And he talks about the joyful mind, gratefulness and buoyancy, a grateful and buoyant mind. And parental mind, you know, taking care of beings and things the way that a parent would take care of their only child. That kind of a sense of there is no separation between your well-being and the well-being of the other person. And magnanimous mind, which is tolerant and views everything from the broadest possible perspective. And for myself lately, I've been thinking of something that I would like to improve in my practice, is getting overly caught up in results, working on something and getting kind of, it becomes kind of a compulsion. This has to happen. I have to achieve that. It has to happen in this amount of time. It has to happen this way. And there's a way that drive is not necessarily inherently a bad drive, right? It gets a lot of stuff done. But I was thinking about, you know, what's the cost? What's the cost of employing that way of working, that way of being? And only recently I just thought, I've sacrificed my joyful mind when I do that. I sacrifice that mind of gratefulness and buoyancy. So, you know, if you really think about what you aspire to, what is possible if you take away all of those limitations of what you think, well, I'm not that good a practitioner, I'm not that good at meditation or whatever, but if you just, you know, removed all of those stories we tell ourselves about our own limitations and limited capacity, you know, what would we really want? And as, you know, something that I really want, that I'm imagining many of you will relate to, is a sense of being awake for my life, of being appreciative of each moment, of not, you know, sleeping through it, of not being on autopilot through it, and having a choice about what my mind is doing. That, fine, I might enjoy thinking about stuff, where, you know, we recently were talking about stories and narratives, and how sometimes it's nice to think about things in terms of a story. But it's also nice to have a choice about that. Okay, now I'm going to reflect in a narrative way, and now I'm going to let that go so that I can actually pay attention to the nature around me on this walk, or something like that. I aspire to take care of my body instead of just using it or abusing it. I can't say that I do that all that well. I mean, most of the time I'm fixated on, you know, what I'm going to get done, and then, you know, don't exercise, don't take care of myself the way that, if I really step back and I think about, not just that I, you know, I don't want to get sick and unhealthy, but also, you know, just in a greater sense, I do want to take care. I want to take care of my body. I want to awaken fully to shunyata, emptiness or boundlessness or oneness. So that, I forget the exact phrasing, but it says the bodhisattva stands firmly, essentially on no ground. There's a firmness and a stability when we're not depending on conditional things. We're not depending on a conditional basis. So in terms of our practice and what we achieve, this is a book called Cave in the Snow by Vicky McKenzie. It's about a woman born Diane Perry and became a Tibetan nun, Tenzin Palmo, and she secluded herself in a remote cave 13,000 feet up in the Himalayas, cut off from the world by mountains and snow, and engaged in 12 years of intense Buddhist meditation there. And for that time, the traditional thing was to sleep. You sleep in a 3-foot square box, so you never lay down. So she did this incredible practice, and but she tells this story. Before she went off to do that, she was a nun and she was in a monastery, and she was feeling kind of dissatisfied with her practice. And she got introduced to the Togdens, who are like spiritual athletes of sorts. So it's a small group of them that were attached to this monastery. Said their mystic feats were legendary. It says, and this, you know, whatever, take this with a grain of salt if you want. One of their forebears, who happened to be married with children, managed to dematerialize not just himself, but his entire family as well, plus his yaks, sheep, goats, and dogs, an assembly of some 62 individuals. According to the story, he went to the Pure Land, and followed by his wife, his children, and finally his animals. So they do things like meditating on the edge of precipices, so that if they fall asleep, they'll fall to their death. You know, hardly eating anything. So it said, for a year, Tenzin Palmo lived with these remarkable men in her own room in one of the houses of their compound. At night, they would sit out in the cold, damp air, their bodies wrapped in wet sheets, learning to dry them through the force of raising the mystic inner heat, Tummo. She heard them leaping in the air and crossing their legs in the full lotus position before landing on the ground. She heard their chants. So she's just very impressed with their practice. But then one of them said to me, you think we yogis are doing some very high, fantastic, esoteric practice. And if only you had the teachings, you also could really take off. Let me tell you, however, that there is nothing I am doing that you have not already been taught. The only difference is I am doing it and you aren't. That has always really struck me. As you think about, like, how much have you already learned in practice? You know, ideally you'd be letting go of this, you wouldn't be judging or blah, blah, blah. I mean, you kind of already know what to do, right? You just, most of the time, you're not actually doing it. So just want to do a brief breakout. And when we come back, I will present the alternative to self-discipline, but I thought we could explore a little bit self-discipline or self-control. What is it? Is it possible to strengthen it? Seem pretty straightforward. All right. Just give like 10 minutes. Let me just rearrange rooms a little bit. Right. I'm back. So self-discipline, self-control, very, very juicy and complex topic. The classic view of self-control is one that apparently dates all the way back to Plato. So I'm going to cite again from Robert Wright's Why Buddhism is True. And he says this metaphor has survived for 2,500 years, where the rational self is the charioteer and the horses are the unruly passions, and the charioteer is keeping it all under control and steering the chariot. So, you know, therefore, we're identified with our sense of, you know, conscious self, our intentions. And then, you know, sometimes we find ourselves able to control the chariot and sometimes not. Sometimes maybe it feels like that charioteer just is AWOL and the chariot's just running, and then charioteer wakes up again and where are we? But it's, modern research, now Buddhism suggests that that's not the case, and modern research is suggesting as well, which is where Robert Wright comes in. He kind of brings those two things together, is showing that our decisions arise from feelings, that, you know, through natural selection, the feelings of attraction or aversion, these are the basis of our decisions. Now, reasoning may enter into it. So he talks about the, you know, the prefrontal cortex, which is where the rational thinking happens. And when that was discovered, psychologists thought, oh, here we go. We've discovered, you know, the charioteer. We've discovered the decision maker. We've discovered the executive eye. But then they've been able to do more research where they can have people do things and they hook them up to a functional MRI, which means they can see what's going on in the brain as things happen. It's not a static picture. And so they did experiments that Wright talks about where, you know, they're inviting people to consider different things that they might buy. And, you know, they show them pictures of them and they tell them what the price is. And they could predict what people were going to buy or choose to theoretically buy based on the activity in the feeling center of their brain. If the, you know, positive was agitated, then they're going to buy it. If it was kind of negative, then they're not going to buy it. It was really not correlated with the activity in the prefrontal cortex. But he says, of course, the rational mind it's really not two separate things, right? The rational mind can participate with the feelings part of our brain. He did an example of like, okay, that looks, you know, like a really cool electric toothbrush and it's a really good price. But the last electric toothbrush I bought broke within a week, you know, like, and that might make us actually, it might feed into a feeling of, no, I don't want to do that. So they're tied together, but ultimately it comes down to this feeling. The rational mind is not in control the way we think it is. And another way of looking at this, which he talks about, is that we have evolved different modules in our brain. So some parts are very old, some parts are newer. They have different functions, and they have different purposes. So one is to fight or freeze, right? Another is to consider things carefully. Another is to find us a mate. Another is to allow us to, create social harmony with people or whatever. And so we may have competing desires. One part of our brain is encouraging us to do something. Another part of our brain is telling us not to. So the idea then is that the decision we make depends on which module is stronger at that moment, which is evoking a stronger feeling. So, you know, the classic thing about here we are, we want to eat some chocolate. And there's a part of us that says, oh, that's going to give me some energy. It's going to feel great. I'm going to feel better. I deserve it. So there's a certain part of us that is drawn to sensual pleasures and the sweetness, probably because, you know, like we said, it used to be harder to find those kinds of things than they are in modern life. So it was probably good for us to be drawn to sweet fruit and, you know, to imbibe that stuff. But now, of course, we have kind of too much of it. And we know that it's, you know, there's going to be negative consequences. And we have a sense of this longer term concern. And that's another part of us. So at the given moment, you know, which module is going to win out? It's not really, it's kind of like this automatic process that it's not really our rational self that's necessarily in charge. But this has implications for practice, because we can choose which modules to strengthen in a way. We can choose which modules to pay attention to, which ones to, for instance, we might, like, because the rational brain does fit in, we might inform ourselves more deeply about the repercussions of choices that we're making. And that might feed back into, you know, actually making us not really want to do that. Even in a sense, just mindfulness of our own lives and minds, and paying attention over time helps with this. So my example is, it took me quite a while to actually be converted fully to all of the precepts. At first I took them, I'm like, sure, whatever. And certain ones of them I knew, like, but I felt like over the years, aspiring to follow them, watching what happened when I broke them, eventually made me not want to break them. Because if you really pay attention, you'll recognize, all right, in this moment, it looks maybe like a little bit of dishonesty isn't going to matter. But actually, no, it has a negative effect. Or, early on in college and stuff, I was like, what do you need, like, committed, honest relationships for? Just, you know, promiscuous sex is fine. And I don't necessarily think that's always bad, but I began to recognize why that precept was there. Because, but you're playing with fire here. So be really careful with people. So that's when I really got converted to that precept, when I was like, oh, I see. It's asking me to be very careful with this. So, in terms of what we want to achieve in our practice, I don't think it's helpful to interpret these things as shoulds or make a judgment about, you should do this more often, you should be more mindful, but rather to see if we can tap into our deepest desires. So not our surface, changeable, self-centered, lazy, our desires for pleasure. Although, I mean, all of that's going to be part of our lives as well, but looking at more deeply, what do we really, really want? And this is what we mean by Buddha nature. He said, if you really look at yourself, if you really look deeply, if you're very mindful and pay attention to what you want in your heart, you will find that you want good things that you actually will want. You will actually be drawn towards self-transcendence. You will be drawn toward awakening and greater wisdom. You will be drawn toward these things. So it's true that we end up with competing desires, but part of our practice can be turning toward that inner experience, sorting through our feelings and learning to question what it is that we really want. So this is where I think of replacing self-discipline with listening to our Buddha nature. So our teacher's teacher, Roshi Kennett, would call this listening to the still small voice within. It's like the Buddha voice inside us isn't going to come out and demand its way. But if we're quiet and we listen, there's like this voice that's telling us, I don't know. I think you really want to do that. So I guess, my contrast, my example of a contrast is like if I'm sitting zazen and my mind is going to the plot of last night's TV show. I mean, just a waste of time, right? That's not how I want to spend my zazen time. Now, the self-discipline approach is to look at that and say, now we wanted to be sitting. We should be letting go of those thoughts. So, come back to the breath and, look how little self-discipline you have. There you go again, thinking, bring back to the breath. Whereas the Buddha nature approach is sincerely asking myself, not dividing myself into warring parts, but asking, what do you really want? You took this time to sit. Do you want to think about that TV show? Do you really want to continue with that? Is that go ahead. That's a good, if that's what you really want. But if I look deeply, that isn't what I want. I do want to be awake. I do want to be here. I know that I could totally deepen my zazen so much more than it already is. And life is short. So I like to think the Buddha nature approach, the self-discipline approach is kind of divisive, one part against another, whereas the Buddha nature approach is more integrative, right? It's like, what do we really want? All of the different parts of ourselves. So this reminded me, and I'll share briefly, and then we can open it up for a few comments and questions. Another piece from Roshi Kennett, which is something that, I don't know if you're going to like this language or not. It's a little weird. I mean, she used her own language and she came from a strong Christian background. But there's something in it here for what we're talking about. So she would often talk about the Lord of the house. And so this is from her commentary on our Kyoju Kaimon, the precept, our precept scripture. The highest truth is called the Buddha treasure. The knowledge of that which is, the knowledge of the unformed, uncreated, unborn, undying, indestructible. The certainty, without doubt, of its existence. And she capitalizes a lot of words, the knowledge of it within oneself, the Buddha living within oneself, the Lord of the house who directs all things. If you study true Buddhism, you will become as the water wherein the dragon dwells. It is necessary to know the true dragon. It is necessary to ask the dragon the lord of the house, at all times to help and to teach. Only if you give all that is required of the price that the dragon asks, will he show you the jewel. You must accept the jewel from the dragon without doubting its value or querying the price. So you get two images, Lord of the House and the Dragon. The Lord of the House within the still small voice, the true nature that can guide us without a sense of self-discipline, I feel like. So I will leave it there for comments or questions. Go ahead and unmute yourself if you want to see something.
Well, I'm just thinking this glorious true sense of guidance would even help with regard to doing the dishes. You know, it seems like it's going to be stooping pretty low for this guidance to think about, to direct in terms of those, you know, those silly little things like washing the dishes or making the bed.
And yet we're told that there is the kingdom of God, right? There is, in each of these moments, that is where complete suchness can be found. Now, do we? You know, most of the time we don't, right? But I guess for me, it feels like that still small voice at that moment, you know, as I'm doing something, is saying, this is it.
Yeah.
Ruth Ann, were you going to say something?
I think, I don't know the author, but chop wood, carry water. Zen master was asked, you know, what do you do after you're enlightened? Chop wood, carry water. I think we, all of us, any time in human history, have a divine intelligence on a cellular level, and life meets you halfway when you're open to whatever experience. So, I don't know, if you have a pet, you clean up from the pet. I mean, that's as divine as any practice.
I find that if I'm near the bed or near the dishes or wherever I'm at, if I'm not actually paying attention to those things, then I'm off somewhere else. Like, oh, where's the closest hike? Or I think I need some more cookies.
Definitely.
I have a lot of time by myself right now, so if I'm not paying attention to where I'm at, which is often just right here, then I can just go off all these different places that I don't actually really want to go to. So that's where I find it helpful.
And I guess that's where I find the, you know, mind wandering during Zazen or during mindfulness. And I don't know, I just really ask, like, what do I really want? I mean, I forget, right? I mean, that's just the nature of our minds, is we forget and wander off. But when I remember, it's like I don't have to wrestle with myself to give up. Like, don't think about that project. If I reach within and I'm like, look, I think about this all day. I really do want a few minutes just to put it down, to just be. to just appreciate my life as it is, as if it doesn't have to be fixed. You know, there's a sincere desire in there that I can tap into. I do want to be here.
So Domio, I just wanted to comment that I see such a nice, lovely parallel between like what you're calling this Buddha nature approach that's non-divisive and really completely accepting of self, and the attitude and presence that we're bringing when we really do shikantaza, where like even thinking of the television show is completely accepted and welcome, and this is who I am in this moment, and I'm completely fine. I am whole and complete. My zazen is whole and complete, however it is arising. And, you know, like zazen's like this microcosm of this way of being that we're trying to bring out and have it permeate everything. And so I love the idea of bringing that mind. It's just, to me, I'm just making this nice connection between this mind that we bring to shikantaza and the mind that I bring to like the list of everything that I want to do in life, but perpetually bullet journal, like, you know, check, 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 check. So I just think that's such a nice, just such a nice parallel of like this mind and heart that we bring to our sitting practices, the mind and heart in so many different ways that we can bring to how we approach ourselves and our lives and really relaxing into this wholehearted deep knowing that who we are and how we live and how we are in this world right now is just fine. It's just fine. And it's so easy to forget that. There's so many ways that it feels not fine or I'm not fine or whatever, but relaxing into that. So I love that kind of bringing those together. Anyway, for me, it made a really nice connection. So thank you for that. Mm.
The only problem is the lord of the house sounds a little weird, especially if you're a woman. But the lady of the house or the mistress of the house, I don't know. A little difficulty with language, but I just feel like Buddhism is so inherently optimistic in a way. It says, you know, you're fine. You have it all within. You might have gotten into some harmful habits and unskillfulness and whatever, but it reminds me of the phrase from Hung Zhu where he talks about you must purify, grind down, and something, all of your apparent habits. So I really need to work hard. They're just apparent in some way. Well, it's 12:15. Thank you all for being here. Oh, let me do my little closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. A good rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.